Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at AnneLiguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. Well, it's Masters Week, such a special time of year. And you golfers and sports historians are well aware of the great amateur golfer Bobby Jones and his role in co-founding Augusta National Golf Club and the Masters Championship. Well, this morning, I share my conversation with Bob Jones IV, the grandson of Bobby Jones. Bob Jones IV tells so many incredible stories about his famous grandfather. And Martin Davis, author and publisher of the greatest of them all, The Legend of Bobby Jones, he joins us as well. That's all on Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and it is my pleasure to say hello to Martin Davis, author and publisher of the greatest of them all, The Legend of Bobby Jones. He's done so many incredible coffee table books. Martin, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Anne. Glad to be here again.
Well, Bobby Jones, what can you say about one of the most influential figures in the history of golf and sport? Obviously a lawyer, a most successful amateur golfer, winning the Grand Slam in 1930 and retired from competition at the age of 28. Just so much to be said about Bobby Jones, but a lot more to Bobby Jones than his actual playing career, right?
Oh, absolutely. He had 13 major championship victories. In those days, the amateur game was certainly equal to, and in some cases better than, the professional game. He won 5 U.S. amateurs, 1 British amateur, 4 U.S. Opens, and 3 British Opens. Played on 5 Walker Cup teams. Went on to found Augusta National Golf Club, and then the Masters. Just an incredible, extraordinary individual. If that's all there was to him, he would have gone down as one of the greatest ever, and certainly into the Hall of Fame for just any one of those, just either his playing or his founding of the club or the Masters. But what people tend to forget, and you have to dig a little bit beyond just the surface, was that his essential character was incredible. He started out as a youngster, he was a real hothead. He used to throw clubs, he'd get angry. The RNA had to admonish him when he played in the Open Championship at St. Andrews in the early 20s. He ripped up his scorecard. USGA had to admonish him as well for throwing clubs, and said, if you keep that up, we're not going to let you play in our events. But it was this essential character that really grew for him. For example, he outgrew all of the hotheadedness, but he also, on 2 occasions in national championships, he called penalties on himself that nobody else saw. And his famous quote was, when someone said, well, why did you even call them? He said, you might as well laud a man for not robbing a bank.
I remember reading about that.
Mm-hmm. He was, a very talented player, and you can make the case that he was one of the greatest players of all time. It may be the greatest, in that from 1923, when he won his first U.S. Open in Inwood, till the time he closed out the Grand Slam in 1930 at Marion, he either finished first or second in every major he played in, 80% of the time. No one else can say that, not Jack, not Ben Hogan, and certainly not Tiger. You know, he became, after he graduated from Georgia Tech, he went to Harvard for a second degree, and this one in English, became a very fine writer, if you ever read his writings. He went to Emory Law School for 2 years, took the bar after his second year. You didn't have to finish law school in those days, became a very fine attorney. He was an opera buff. He's what we would call a Renaissance man.
Sure, a true Renaissance man.
There was just so much to him. And for that, you know, we tend to forget a lot of that, but really interesting. There was Grantland Rice, who was America's first great golf writer, maybe the greatest ever, sports writer, was a good friend of Jones's and was a founding member of Augusta National. And he wrote, and Jones kept this framed on his desk. And let me it's just a very short little couplet. For when the one great scorer comes to write against your name, he writes not whether you won or lost, but how you played the game. And that's how Jones led his entire life. There wasn't a lot of golf memorabilia in his office. There were just two little things, nothing to do with the Grand Slam, but this frame piece was on his desk. And I think that really summed Jones up the best. It's how you played the game.
That's right. I talked to Bob Jones IV, mm-hmm. grandson of Bobby Jones, and he had so much insight, Marty. It's just an incredible mm-hmm. interview, if I may say so myself. He was talking about his grandfather, so gentle and so sweet, but he just had such a fierce competitor that carried over, obviously, to his career on the golf course. Nobody does what Bobby Jones did in such a short period of time. He didn't play long. And he was ailing. He was always sickly as a child. But just that fierce competitiveness was unbelievable, how he just turned it on when he was on the golf course. And Bob Jones IV also said that his grandfather was very much in the present, always, even toward the end of his life. Bob Jones IV, the grandson, only knew his grandfather when he was ailing. Unfortunately, his grandfather was in a wheelchair the majority of the time that Bob Jones IV, you know, knew his grandfather. And he never talked about his glorious career with his grandson. He never went back. He only stayed in the presence. He never talked about creating Augusta National with Clifford Roberts. He never talked about creating the Masters. He never would look back. He was always in the presence, which I thought was just fascinating.
Yeah, I've heard Bob say that. You know, Herb Wynn wrote, and let me see if I can remember part of it, that Jones had the best life had to offer and the worst as well, and handled both with equal aplomb. You know, it was 1947, 1948 when he played his last golf, and he lived until, you know, the early 1970s. So 71, I think, is when he passed away. And he had this horrible disease of the spinal column called syringomyelia, right, which there still isn't a cure for. But he was just this gracious, wonderful, wonderful man.
Definitely. And on his deathbed, his son told me in this show, you'll hear this interview with Bob Jones IV. His son said that even on his deathbed, Bobby Jones said, boy, if this is what dying is like, it's beautiful. So he even carried that presence, that amazing persona,
hey,
before he passed.
You know who else was like that? You'll get a kick out of this. Byron Nelson was very much like that. When Byron had to have a hip operation when he was in his late 80s, and the doctor pulled him aside and said, "Byron, you know, at your age, you may not come out of the anesthetic." And he said, "So I want to give you a chance not to have the operation." So Byron said, "Let me see if I understand this. if I come out of the operation and it works, I'll be able to play golf again. And the doctor said, yes. And then Byron said, and if I don't come out of the operation, I'm going to heaven. And that was the essence of Jones was the same way. But Byron was very thoughtful and strong in his beliefs. And it, apparently Jones was too. He was, and the other thing I wanted to mention was that he would lose 10 to 15 pounds in the course of a tournament. After he, instead of throwing clubs or ripping up scorecards, he internalized everything, and it would just consume him. In the course of a tournament over a week, he would lose 10 to 15 pounds, which is amazing.
And he wasn't a huge guy as it was, no. Right?
No, he wasn't. He was really an extraordinary individual. And when you look at the people that have been involved in the golf world, we've really been blessed that we've had many, not just one or two extraordinary individuals, like Arnold, and certainly Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson, of course, just some really incredible people. And then the
Jack
writers.
Nicklaus.
Yeah, Jack and Bernard Darwin is the writer. And, you know, my old friend, Herbert Warren Wind, Alistair Cook, just amazing, amazing, you know, learned writers and sportsmen.
I know, Martin, you have another classic coming out. Arnold Palmer, American Hero. You've been working on this for a long time. I'm very excited to see this book.
Yeah, it's going to come out in time in conjunction with the U.S. Open in June. As I'm sure your listeners will remember or have read about, that's where Arnold lost the second playoff. It was the second one in a row for the U.S. Open at Julie Boros at the Country Club, where the Open's going to be this year. I feel, Ann, like I've gone 15 rounds with Smoke and Joe and just got pummeled. The book is now, it's that large coffee table size and it's 370 pages. So it's at the printer now.
Unbelievable. How many have you done, Marty?
This is my 39th book.
What an achievement, truly, because they're so difficult to put together. They take so much time and they're really works of art. You came to one of our Anne LaGoria Foundation Charity Golf Classic tournaments. We were at Friar's Head and you were a big hit. You were signing the Ryder Cup book, if I remember correctly. And what a treat. Yeah. Everybody was able to take home. First of all, it weighs how many pounds?
9 pounds. 9 pounds.
I remember carrying your book home, your another book that you were able to do back from, where were we? Whistling Straits last year. I carried it home.
You know, it's funny. The joke is that if you get, it's 500 pages and that's 11 by 14 overall size. The joke is that if you get tired reading it, you can always work out with it because it weighs 9 pounds.
Well, it must be tremendously satisfying when you finally do finish these masterpieces.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for referring to them. This is in that big book series, this is the seventh one in the series. And yeah, yes, it is. It's extremely satisfying. And, you know, you just kind of, it's like now that I sent it to the printer last week, and now it's like a downer. You know, it's kind of like, now what do I do?
I'm sure you'll have plenty to do. It's Masters Week. It's spring is in the air. It's exciting. The azaleas are out. The magnolias are in full bloom. What does Masters Week mean to you, Martin Davis?
Well, it means I get to have dinner with you one night. It's sort of rebirth. You know, it is really the unofficial official beginning of the golf season. You know, you come down Augusta, spring is out up in our area, up in the New York metro area. It's, you know, it's still chilly and iffy and you can still get a little snow now and then and it gets cold, but down here it's spring. And when you get to Augusta, everything's green. And then somehow by the end of the week, usually All the flowers are in bloom. You know, I they must have a line to God to tell them when to let the flowers open up.
It's heaven on earth for sure.
It really is.
Augusta National. Who are you picking? I can't let you go unless you until you venture a pick to win the Masters 2022.
Even though he's young, sentimentally, I think I'd love to see Rory do it. I would like to. Also, Kevin Kisner is playing extremely well.
Martin Davis, thanks so much. I appreciate your insight on the great Bobby Jones and look forward to seeing you in Augusta, Georgia.
Love you, Annie. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori, and it is my pleasure to say hello to Dr. Bob Jones, the fourth sports psychologist at the Behavioral Institute of Atlanta, and the grandson of Bobby Jones, founder with Clifford Roberts of Augusta National Golf Club and of the Masters. Welcome, Dr. Jones.
Thank you so much, Ann. It's good to be with you again.
Masters Week is in full swing. What is this week like for you?
Well, it's a bit of a whirlwind most of the time. Most of the time we end up going over, my wife and I end up going to Augusta early in the week. But this year we're only going to be able to go on Friday and have to come back on Saturday. But it's just a whirlwind of activity. A lot of interviews, a lot of catching up with old friends such as yourself, and making sure that the story of my grandfather gets out there.
You were one of seven grandchildren of Bobby Jones and his wife, Mary. And talk a little bit about what it was like kind of growing up and how much time did you get to spend with him?
Well, he was ill most of my life, actually all of my life. He had a very, very rare disease called syringomyelia, which is very, very complicated to explain, but very, very hellish to watch. So a lot of the activities that you would normally, a grandson would normally do with his grandfather, I never got a chance to do with him. It was simply mainly spending time with him in the morning before he would go to work and having breakfast with him and just talking. And then in the evening when he would come home, reversing the procedure where I would spend time with him after dinner up until it was time for him to go to bed. On the weekends, he and my father would watch golf, and I would sit in the room with them and just listen as they analyzed whatever tournament happened to be on the TV that weekend. And you know, and it's funny, it wasn't until I was an adult that it finally occurred to me. I've always been very harsh on golf announcers, but I never could figure out why, because I realized it's an extraordinarily exacting thing. And then all of a sudden it occurred to me, when you grow up listening to Bobby Jones analyze a golf tournament, everything else just has a way of fading in comparison. So
you would sit there with your dad and your grandfather, Bobby Jones, and just listen to them. I'm sure the analysis was just spot on and ingenious, right?
It was. You know, Bub's strategies, the way he thought, even many, many years after the fact, the way he would approach watching a golf tournament and discussing strategy, it really didn't change much from the 1960s until when he was playing in the 1920s. He believed in something that actually he got from somebody else, but it was called courageous timidity. And that is that he felt that the way to approach a golf hole was very straightforwardly. You shoot for the wide part of the fairway and the wide part of the green. And then he said several times during the round, something will appeal to your eye or to your shot shape that just says, now is the time to get aggressive. And that's the one, and that's when you take the chances. And, you know, I keep thinking back to a number of years ago in the Masters, when Chip Beck needed to go for the 15th green and two to have a chance to birdie and possibly win. And he laid up short of the pond and unfortunately, I believe, chunked it in the water. And a lot of the media got on him about that. But I remember thinking at the time, that's probably how Bub is what we called my grandfather. That's probably how Bub would have played the shot.
Bub, so. I love it. So he describes kind of going for it almost as if it were instinctive for him. He would just have this feeling, this is when I need to play aggressive.
Yeah, something that appealed to his eye or absolutely fit his shot shape. You know, one of the things he always enjoyed, because he tended to move the ball from right to left, is he always enjoyed when a pin would be cut on the right side of the green, because he could just go right at the pin. And if he hit it straight, well, he's right next to the hole. And if he hits his usual draw, he's 15 feet to the left. Of course, with my usual shot shape, I can go right for the pin too. The difference is I'm 20 yards to the left. So, you know. It's just proof that the gene pool dilutes over time. So.
Well, of course, your grandfather, Bobby Jones, was one of the most influential figures in the history of sport. He was a lawyer and obviously the most successful amateur golfer, playing from 1923 to 1930 and winning the Grand Slam of Golf in 1930. Did he ever share any stories about his memorable career to you when you were young?
No, he would not talk about that. Everything I learned about what he thought about golf, I had to learn just from listening him to talk about others. But there's a really practical reason why he wouldn't discuss it. And that was, you have to remember that my grandfather was a very ill man. And the way that he learned to cope with that sickness was by staying very, very focused in the present. He wouldn't let his mind drift to the glory days of when he played tournament golf, nor would he allow it to move forward into what was probably going to be a very bleak future. And to understand that, you have to understand a little something about his psyche. There, he used to always say, as I believe he said to Al Laney of the International Herald Tribune, after he got ill, Al Laney asked him, well, Bob, tell me, what is this condition that you have? And Bub said, well, Al, I will tell you straight up. He said, it's a very bad nerve condition, a nerve disease. He said, it is not going to get better. It's going to get worse, and it's going to keep getting worse. But Al, he said, you have to remember that in golf, we play the ball as it lies. And now we won't talk about this again. And he never really did. But I think that's more than just a cliche with him. It actually is how he approached life. He was very, very present focused. Another story in that regard was with Charlie Price, who was a longtime editor of Golf Magazine, and actually was my grandfather's editors for some of his books. And Charlie and my grandfather were sitting around the Jones cabin during the Masters one year, and Bub was eating his lunch. And there were a couple of former U.S. Open champions that came in to talk to him. And they wanted to talk about all the great years when they were playing competitive golf. And Bob listened and was polite and everything. And after about 15 minutes, he said, well, boys, it's been great to see you, but now I'm afraid I'm going to have to run you out because Charlie and I have to talk about some business. So off they went, and Charlie and Bob are sitting in the room. And finally, Price turns to my grandfather and he says, well, Bob, what was it you wanted to talk to me about? And Bub just looked at him and said, oh, nothing. I just couldn't sit around and just talk. It would just spend all that time in nostalgia. And that's how he was.
Wow. Interesting. So he did not like to look back. About what age was he when he got that disease?
Well, it sort of depends. He probably contracted the disease when he was struck by a brick from a chimney that was hit by lightning at Eastlake in 1929. He had a few very unusual neurological symptoms that persisted, came on after that, but it did not really start getting serious until after World War II. From about 1946 to 1948, he went through some exploratory surgeries at Emory, and then finally in 1950 he went to see Houston Merritt, who was a great neurologist. Actually wrote what is still the textbook on neurology. And he did that up at Teachers College at Columbia in New York. And Merritt was the one who gave him the diagnosis of syringomyelia. Interestingly, at the time, it was generally thought that syringomyelia and its cousin, Chiari malformation, affected maybe 100,000 people. We now know that 3 million are affected by either Chiari or syringomyelia. So it's still uncommon, but nowhere near as uncommon as it was initially thought to be.
And still no cure for it?
Still no cure. We're trying to find one. We have a foundation that we're involved with, the Bobby Jones, Chiari, and Siringo Maiilia Foundation. And can I put in a shameless plug?
Absolutely, please.
Your listeners, if they would like to, can go to bobbyjonescsf.org, and they can learn about Siringo Maiilia, and if they feel so moved, make a donation and help us find the cure.
Yeah, I know he was 69 when he passed in 1971, and boy, so he did not share any memories with you about his career, and I assume then he did not really want to talk about the Masters and about building Augusta National, just such a gorgeous golf course built on a former nursery called Fruitland. I mean, hence the names of the holes, from Tea Olive, Flowering Peach, Magnolia, Juniper, to the Amen Corner Holes, White Dogwood, Golden Bell, Azalea. I mean, something I'm sure he was tremendously proud, but he never spoke about it.
No, you know, and I think too, part of that is that might have been just a little difficult. I remember when I first went to the Masters in 1970, I was 12 years old. And the reason I waited was because back then Cliff had a rule that you couldn't come to the Masters until you were 12 years old. And so that's when I went. And Bub wasn't there that year. And I remember about a week after, I called him up and I said, "Hey, Bub, how are you?" And he said, "Oh, I'm fine, son. How are you?" And I said, "I'm great." He said, "I hear you went to Augusta." I said, "Yes, I did, sir." He said, "How'd you like it?" And I said, "Bub, it's the most incredible thing I think I've ever seen." And he just got really, really quiet. And after a few seconds, he just said, "Well, son, that's just fine. Now, when do you go back to school?" And it wasn't until years later that it finally pieced something together. I was talking with my wife, Mimi, and I told her that story. And I said, you know, it always struck me as an odd reaction from him. And she said, "I don't think it's so odd at all." That's, "Why not?" She said, "Well, it was probably a difficult conversation with him for him to have, because I suspect that was a moment he probably had wanted to be able to share with you, not just hear about it on the phone." But I never really got that, because as I said, Bub was like a laser beam when he needed to be.
Wow. That's probably, you know, a great diagnosis, I guess. I don't know. I mean, if he's in a wheelchair, he's suffering like that, and he wished he could have shared that with his grandson. I'm sure.
Sure. Yeah. I'm sure. Well, I would have loved that myself. But you know, the funny thing is, Anne, because that's the man as he was when I grew up, I never really knew him in any other way. I mean, really, the first time I encountered the magnitude of just who Bobby Jones was that first year that I went to the Masters. And I got there late at night. It was pitch black dark. I went to sleep in the Jones cabin, and my dad was in the room with me. And I've always been an early riser. I woke up at like 6:15 in the morning, and I walk out on the patio of the Jones cabin, which overlooks the 10th tee. And basically, you see the whole vista. And the mowers were just starting out in the morning. And I looked at that and I was absolutely blown away, because even at 12 years old, I knew instinctively that everything that I was seeing had existed in my grandfather's mind before a shovel full of dirt had ever even been turned over on that property. And it just boggled my mind. But the real tragedy of what happened to him physically did not get to me until the first time I saw the instructional videos that he did with Warner Brothers back in the early 1930s, and I actually saw him move, and I saw him swing a golf club, and that grace and that power was just, and then when I heard his voice coming out of that screen, and it really hit me who he really was in his prime. Not to say that who he was when he was ill was not impressive, because, you know, it's really easy to do great stuff well. It's not so easy to have to deal with the bad stuff just as well, which is a rough paraphrase of something Herbert Warren Wynne said.
Well, gosh, yeah, to look back on his career and to see him in those clinics and the gorgeous swing, and, you know, he won 13 majors of the 31 that he played. That's a very good winning percentage.
Well, if you like that one, let's try this one on for size. He played in 10 United States Opens. He won four of them. He was finished runner up in four of them. Two of those he lost in a playoff. One tournament he lost, by the way, because he called a one shot penalty on himself. And the worst he ever finished in any US Open was tied for 11th. That's a pretty stunning record.
Very stunning. And I know when I was reading on the history of the Masters and Augusta National, it's well known that he really did not want the championship to be called the Masters. He thought it was too presumptuous.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He thought, and that was something that Cliff wanted. And, you know, Cliff had, for all the friction that existed between them, that friction had a way of being kind of like the grain of sand in the oyster. It kind of makes a beautiful pearl. And Cliff liked the Masters. In fact, Bub in private used to refer to it as the so-called Masters. That's how angry he got about it. But then in 1960, when Palmer won his second green jacket in such dramatic fashion, Bub finally relented. And believe me, Bub was a stubborn man. He didn't change his mind very easily. But after Palmer won in 1960, Bub said, well, I suppose Masters really is the appropriate term now. And after that, that's how he would refer to it. So
I love that story. Great story. Yeah. Did your father share any memories with you about his dad or about going to Augusta National with his father?
He did. Dad, of course, used to play a lot of golf with my grandfather. They had a very interesting relationship. Dad was a very fine player. You know, Bub's handicap at its peak was calculated to be something like +8, playing with basically broomsticks and, you know, 40 compression balls. My dad at his peak was calculated to be a +3. And they would discuss golf all the time. Particularly, Bub used to like to go around with Dad, especially even after Bub got sick. Sometimes Bub would go around with my dad when he was playing, and he would explain different shot values on the golf course. For example, years ago, number 5 used to have tremendous options to it. The green complex was a little bit different, and the way the hole was laid out, you basically had two choices, and one of them was to knock the ball down, you know, flight it down, land the ball short of the green, and let it release onto the green. The second would be, of course, to throw it high up in the air and let it land like a dart. And Bub used to say that you know, what you wanted to do, which shot you chose, depended on which direction the wind was coming from. And I said to my father at the time, I said, well, you know, Dad, that makes it sound really easy. He said, well, yeah, but for your grandfather, that they were all pretty easy. He said, you have to understand, son, and this is something that Bub told my dad. He said, you have to understand that when Bub was hitting the golf ball, he wasn't just planning a shot. He was planning how deeply he wanted to compress the golf ball, and also how long did he want to keep the ball on the face of the club at impact before releasing it to the target. Sometimes Bub felt as though the face of his club had like glue on it and the ball was just stuck to it and he was throwing it off at the target. Now, to put that in perspective, that is very much akin to how Ted Williams used to describe playing
baseball.
I was
just going to bring that up.
Yes.
Because I interviewed Ted Williams way back in the day. And of course, yeah. I always read where he could see the seams. His vision was so good, he could see the seams on a fastball. And he talked about that in our interview years ago.
Well, yeah. And what that is really great champions will get that. And what that is, I mean, the technical name for it is this. You have a sympathetic nervous system and a parasympathetic nervous system. I'm not going to go into the weeds on that, but let's just put it this way. These are people that have found ways to develop their parasympathetic nervous system to almost superhuman levels. They may not even know how they did it, but that's what they did. And that's what made people like Ted Williams and Bub, just so unbelievably good and very dangerous if you're an opponent.
Sure. And they have that intangible. When you think of these just extraordinary athletes, you know, from your grandfather to Ted Williams to maybe Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jordan, they had that sixth sense about them that perhaps relates another to one, what you were describing.
I mean, another one I would put in that list, well, certainly in golf, I mean, you've also got what, Hogan, Jack, Tiger, but the other athlete though that really popped into my head when you were going through that would have been Roger Federer, who's another
absolutely.
One. Absolutely. Anyway, but you know, the thing that was interesting, I think, in my grandfather's case, Anne, is that, you know, he gets written about now as he was so kind and so gentle and so sweet. And like, it's like he walked like 3 feet off the ground, right? Bub was kind and he was gentle, but he was also a very fierce competitor. Absolutely, absolutely a ferocious competitor. Nobody does what he did in such a short span of time unless they have an incredible killer instinct. And I'll give you an example. 1929, he blows a lead at Winged Foot and faces a 12-foot putt that he has to make to tie Al Espinosa for the Open Championship on the West Course. And he stands over the putt and he makes it. The ball runs up to the edge of the hole. And on the very last revolution, just pop, falls into the hole. The USGA comes up and says, all right, guys, the playoff will start tomorrow morning at 8:00. And Bub said, I'm sorry, we can't do that. We need to push it back an hour and start it at 9:00. And now the United States Golf Association is not in the habit of being told when their playoffs are going to begin. But they said, well, why is that, Bub? And he said, Al's a Catholic and he needs to go to mass. And so they went down the street. I think it's St. Vincent's Church, just down the street in Mamaroneck. And the Espinosas and the Joneses sat on the first row and went to mass together. And the press later said, and I'm saying this just to point out his competitive spirit, the press later said that that time at mass was the only prayer Espinosa had all day because Bub went out and beat him in the playoffs by 23 shots. You don't do that without a very strong killer instinct.
Absolutely. That's another great story. Well, do you think your grandfather had any regrets at all? I mean, when you look back on his career, he never turned professional. Obviously, back then, there wasn't the money that's in the game now. But he, you know, he was an attorney and he wasn't, you know, a golfaholic, so to speak. It's not like he was obsessed with golf.
Well, he was and he wasn't. He did spend an incredible amount of time thinking about the game. Which, by the way, you know, back in his day, he couldn't hit a lot of practice balls because the hickory shafts couldn't stand that. So he practiced a lot mentally. But I think if he had one, there is one thing that I wouldn't say regret, but there was one thing that disturbed him immensely. And that was after the market crash in 1929, he found out that some very dear friends of his in Atlanta were betting large sums of money on him to win golf tournaments. And he got really kind of gruff about it, said, well, I'm not a blankety blank racehorse. But he was really worried about that. Early in 1930, you know, very often you'll see these stories that appear about how Bobby Jones bet $1,000 on himself at 60 right. to 1 to win the Grand Slam. It's not true.
That wasn't true. He did not bet on himself?
Not in the slightest. But I'll tell you who did. There was another Bobby that did, and that was Bobby Cruikshank. Bobby Cruikshank in the spring of 1930 said that nobody is going to beat Bob Jones this year. There isn't one person that can beat this man this year. And he believed it so strongly that he went to a bookmaking house in England and plopped down, it was either $1,000 or £1,000. On Bub to win all four major championships. Bub didn't mind a little $5 wager, but I think if Bub were to suspect that somehow his name was going to like become associated as like the Pete Rose of golf, I don't think he would have been pleased by that.
How do you think that story got misconstrued? He never bet on himself to win?
Never. Never. Now, I mean, as I said, he'd go out and play a little $5 Nassau.
But yeah, but a major title.
No, you play the game for the sake of the game. Now, I'll tell you one thing he did do, though, just to tell you, he wasn't above a little bet periodically. He was out playing a practice round with Walter Hagen. I forget what year this happened, but it was on a par three, and Bub hit his shot up on the green, and Walter Hagen hit his ball into a bunker. So they're walking up to the green, and Bub reaches in his pocket and pulls out a $20 bill and crumples it up in a little ball, turns to his caddy, and he says, go over there and throw this 20 down in the bunker next to Hagen's ball. So the caddy does. He tosses the 20 in there, and off they go in the green. Hagen hits it out there. Well, Hagen first goes into the bunker. He sees this $20 bill there. He reaches over, picks it up, puts it in his pocket. Then he takes his club out, hits the ball up to about 4 feet from the hole. He makes the putt for a three. Bub two putts for a three. They're walking to the next tee. And Bub said to him, he said, well, Walter, what'd you have on that hole? Walter said, I had three. Bub said, no, you didn't. You had a five. Walter said, what do you mean? Bub said, you removed a loose obstruction in the hazard.
That's classic. So
I wasn't a little scared to use that when it came to his own advantage, but no, not the other kind of advantage. Story though about the betting kind of makes the rounds about every 3 or 4 years.
Interesting. What's your favorite Masters memory?
My favorite Masters memory was actually has not much all to do with the tournament itself. About 20 years ago, Mimi and I were at the tournament. We were down around Amen Corner, and I had to be out there. I had to go to a meeting later in the day, so I'm wearing a shirt and tie, which you know how hot it gets there. And I'm walking up the hill on number 10, and there's some players coming down 10, and there's this old man standing next to me, and he's got this hat on that has every Masters badge that he's ever had on it. He had a bunch. And this older guy, we watched the player hit the shot, and I'm getting ready to walk up the hill, and this man says to me, he said, excuse me, he said, I see by your name badge, it says Bob Jones. Are you related to Bobby Jones? And I said, yes, sir, I am. He introduced himself, and he said, I wanted to tell you, when I first started, I've been coming here for a long time, and I looked at his hat, and I said, yes, I can see that. And he said, when I first came here, I remember first year I was here, I was down around Amen Corner, and your grandfather drove up in a golf cart, and your father was with him. And they stopped and talked with me, and they wanted to know who I was, where I was from, how was I enjoying the tournament. And he said, you know, I was just a kid. I was in the Army, and I was at Fort Gordon, and I was just a soldier. And here, the greatest golfer in history is stopping to find out how I'm enjoying the tournament. He said, your grandfather was so nice. And this is the part that kind of just stuck with me. He said, the neatest thing about it, Mr. Jones, is that your grandfather didn't have to do that. And yet he did. And, you know, I suppose I could remember things like, you know, Nicklaus making the putt in 86, or Gary Player shooting 30 on the back in 78. But what I really associate with the Masters is an old man by the side of number 10 talking to me about the impact that my grandfather made in his life just by common courtesy.
Another great story, Dr. Bob Jones IV. Well, I know you're a sports psychologist, so let's kind of shift to that department. And
sure.
What do you think Tiger is thinking at this point? What's going through his mind is, he has to decide if he is going to play a little over a year after that horrible, horrible, scary car crash. And, you know, will his body endure? Can it endure the strenuous hilly terrain? It's, you know, I understand he's been practicing this week. He's been at Augusta National. He came in on early last week with his son. At this point of the taping of this interview, we have not heard if Tiger is going to play. He is on the list as not pulling out yet. So what's going through Tiger's mind, do you think, from a sports psychologist standpoint?
You know, I don't really know. And I'm always hesitant to, diagnose people that I've never met. I can tell you what my preference would be. I don't know if I don't care if he would go out and play poorly. I think just to see Tiger there would be an incredible thing for the game of golf. You know, there's been a big change in Tiger since 2018. I was at East Lake when he won at 2018, and I was at the Masters when he won the following spring. And there was a different connection that Tiger had with the people there in those two victories. You know, when he was younger and he was so dominant and he was so just tightly wrapped, and there was almost like his golf was incredible, but you just sort of wondered, where was the humanity? But then in 2018 and 2019, we saw a different side of Tiger Woods. We saw not only just a brilliant golfer, but also we saw a real human persona that just connected with everybody that was there. And so I guess if nothing else, I'd love to see him tee off, because I think that's the kind of thing that that our sport needs. It just needs the connection with the champion who really shows what the game can bring out of people.
Sure.
That's a way of dodging your question, but I hope it somewhat answers it.
I mean, obviously his win in 2019, you know, his fifth green jacket, his 15th Grand Slam title, a win for the ages, a comeback win for the ages then.
Oh, yeah.
So could you imagine him just coming and playing this 2022 Masters? I agree with you. It would be such an accomplishment just for him physically to get out there and walk the course, hopefully make the cut,
Walk
that course and play all 4 days. Wouldn't that be great?
One of
my favorite Masters memories, Bob, is this is my 24th Masters, and doing updates and doing my show on WFAN in New York, and the update guy at FAN back in 2005 threw it to me to do my update right as Tiger hit his infamous chip shot on the par 3 16th in 2005.
Yes.
And I was able to pretty much describe the action because it was literally a couple of seconds worth, but it happened. The timing was just impeccable. And of course, he hit that shot 20 feet away from the cup and it dramatically went into the hole. And then he went on to win in 2005 in a playoff. But boy, and then of course, Phil Mickelson draining that 20 footer to win his first major in 2004. And then Phil jumping 4 feet in the air. That was pretty special. But I wanted to ask you about Phil again, from a sports psychologist standpoint. Phil will not be playing in this year's Masters. What's your take on everything that's going down with Phil Mickelson right now?
I have no idea. You know, I read the comments. I think I read the comments that he made about all that's going on with Saudi Arabia, and they're wanting to enter the professional golf arena. And I reckon, you know, and I know that's got to be tough for him, because even Phil came out and said later that, I probably could have phrased that a little differently. I don't know what would necessarily go on there. I would imagine that's difficult. Phil has generally gotten very, very, you know, Phil has generally gotten very, very good coverage over the years, because he does have a tendency to be extremely personable. But, you know, sooner or later, the fishbowl catches up to everybody, the fishbowl that is the world that we kind of live in. And I think that's kind of where Phil is right now. As again, it's hard to speculate on a person you don't really know. I do feel sorry for him in that sense, because, you know, Bub never had to deal with anything like this, you know, because, I mean, there were people who knew all about Bobby Jones, but wouldn't be able to pick him out of a lineup, because there was no ESPN. They might see him on a newsreel, but I mean, when he had his second ticker tape parade in New York City, he walked out of the Waldorf Astoria to have a cigarette in the evening, and they're sweeping up the street in front, and Bub's just smoking a cigarette, and this policeman's kind of wandering along, and Bub's talking to the cop, and finally says, "Officer, what's all the fuss about?" And the cop just looks back and says, "It's just a parade for some damn golfer." Not knowing that the golfer is standing right next to him. Now, that's a world that people like Tiger and Phil, they don't have the luxury of living in that world. Everything they do, for good or for bad, is going to get magnified far out of proportion than it would if the same thing had happened to you or to me. Because ultimately, again, who's picking us out of the lineup? But these guys, I mean, you're talking about somebody, I mean, Bub's phone number was published in the Atlanta White Pages, his home phone number. Tiger could not get in a car and go have dinner at McDonald's if he wanted to. And probably neither could Phil.
So true.
So it's
totally
a lot
different
of
world.
It totally is. Absolutely.
Bob, from a sports psychology standpoint, what does it take mentally to win a Masters title?
Well, not having won one, that's a little hard to say, but I'll give it a shot. One of the things that's really important, and this is something I work on with the people that I deal with of all levels, is I always tell them that you have to be focused simply on what you're dealing with at that moment. And in other words, it literally is the shot at hand. And the reason, pardon me, you're hearing my dogs, but the reason that is so difficult is because the bigger the pressure, the bigger the event, the green jacket or the US Open trophy or the claret jug, right? The easier it is to try to pull your mind just a little bit away from the task at hand. And the minute that happens, the minute you lose control of that mental focus, well, it's pretty much all over. Good example. How many times in the 1960s and early 70s did Bert Yancey almost win the Masters? And Bert used to say, my biggest problem is I was always trying the green jacket on after 69 holes.
Right. And your grandfather did such a great job at staying in the moment, as you described earlier in our conversation, even years later when he was ailing and in a wheelchair.
Yes.
He stayed in that moment and didn't look back at all.
No, and even to the point, Anne, that by the time he finally died, he was in his final illness. The priest had come over from Christ the King Church and baptized him and given him his first communion, and they were talking afterwards, and then later that day, he was about to go unconscious for the last time, and his final words were, he looked up at all of his family, his final words before he lost consciousness was, if this is what it's like to die, it's beautiful. Now, what does that tell you about focus and present moment? Not, gosh, look at what I've done with the last 25 years of my life and what's happened to me, but if this is what it's like to die, it's beautiful.
Wow.
What
a beautiful statement. And I can't think of a better way to end this just very insightful interview, Dr. Bob Jones IV. So many great stories about your grandfather. I so appreciate you taking the time to come on, and continued success. Let's do it again. I just love talking to you.
I love to do it, Anne. It's always a pleasure. And I hope you have a great time in Augusta. I hope our paths will cross.
Dr. Bob Jones IV, thanks so much.
My thanks to Bob Jones IV, to Martin Davis, and to Mike Goodsell in production. And to quote the legendary Bob Jones, who has been the subject of this sports interview show, competitive golf is played mainly on a 5.5-inch course, the space between your ears. So, so true. Have a great weekend, everybody. Be safe, be kind, and I'll talk to you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Anne Liguori.